Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to Conspiranormal. I hope everyone is out there staying warm, first of all, because it's been like extremely cold, and we just had, well, I just had here in Nashville, just like a shit ton of snow just drop on us through the whole entire state.
Most of the country seems to be frozen.
We're living in a true winter wonderland right now. I don't know exactly how that works, but here we are. So continuing, getting back into doing shows regularly now, we have Recluse with us, who really needs no introduction. Recluse has been on the show quite a lot. He's been a part of our Strange Realities conference for the last 3 years. And if you guys also should know him from the Farm podcast as well. But he has a new book out called The Art Book 1, The Secret History of Psywar, Conspiratainment, and the Shattering of Reality. And when I first saw the cover of this book, which of course I'm showing it, but no one is going to see it on the podcast, but you know,
we'll put
something on there in the graphic. But when I first saw the cover of this book, I actually thought this was like a graphic novel whenever I saw it. And I actually, right at the end of the conference this last year, I went ahead and bought it from Mr. Recluse.
Same here.
And been reading it in preparation for this interview. So, Stephen, welcome back to Conspiranormal, man.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me on. And just God bless my peeps in Wisconsin, man. I've been looking at the weather reports from out there. I mean, it's bad in a lot of the U.S. as we're recording this, but yeah, that there's was it negative 26 degrees with the wind chill. That's brutal. And having been out there in Milwaukee area and experienced that wind off of the Great Lakes during winter time, it's no joke, man. Everybody in that area, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, man, stay warm, folks. I know it's been really rough on you guys out there.
Yeah, well, hopefully by the time this is out, everybody will be warm. So
yeah, here's hoping everybody's thawed out a little bit.
Yeah, this little mini ice age will have
hopefully
ended.
You know, both of our podcasts can give people some entertainment if they're kind of, you know, stuck at home too.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine there's a lot of people snowed in right about now. So
yeah, for sure. I have been for like the last 2 days, basically. I mean, I took the car out just for a little bit today because some of the main roads are scraped, but not a lot of the back roads are. So just
downtime is always a great time to explore these parapolitical mysteries, though.
Indeed they are. Yes. And well, we're going to talk about primarily about this book. And you know, a question that I ask people whenever they write a book or they've got a book to talk about is, what was on your mind when you wanted to write this book? And this is also, it said the art book one, so there's going to be, I think, two more. So what's your plan for the series of the books? What do you want to accomplish with the series?
Well, getting back to like your first point, this actually started, I think, is what was going to be kind of like an extended essay. I was thinking, I would do something on the history of QAnon and how it developed. And yeah, it'd be like 30, 40,000 words or something like that, a real quickie, And I think I started working on it in late 2020. I think by about 2022, when I was about 150,000 words into it, I was like, yeah, this is not going to be remotely quick if that hadn't already set in by this point in time. And not only that, but I needed to start reconceiving it from just a single work into multiple works, because at this point, I'm entering into war and peace territory, basically. It was way too much information, I think, for one tome. So that led to kind of a prolonged period of like writer's block and trying to figure out how to divide it up. And then finally, I kind of had a eureka moment about a little over a year ago, when it finally sort of dawned on me how it would work as a trilogy. And that kind of like put my ass into motion again and got the first book done. So that, and then I have a pretty good chunk of the third book ready already. It's going to be the second one, which is going to require a lot of work, because I've got to really go back and start getting into the history of Rosicrucianism, which, God help me, goes all the way back to like the Franciscans and just a lot of other stuff. So it's going to be a bit of a research project with that. But I mean, hopefully, once I get over sort of the hump of the kind of early historical stuff, it'll start flowing a lot smoother. And again, a good chunk of book three is already ready. So yeah, here's hoping it'll be done in the next couple of years at least.
Okay. Well, what's the overarching theme of these three books? Like what is the idea behind them that you want to explore?
Well, the more I worked on it, I think it just dawned on me fundamentally the heart of the theme of the work is really the nature of reality, how we conceive it, how it's manipulated, and whether it can be totally destroyed and recreated, which I think is a process that we're currently all living through right now. So this was going to be my attempt to kind of explore the early history of this, especially with an emphasis on how it's manipulated, especially through the various arts and different groups that have focused on these manipulations. And of course, with the first book, the title's a bit of a giveaway, but the first book, I really wanted to focus on the psychological warfare aspect of this. And then getting into the second book, kind of following the development of conspiratainment and its origins really in Rosicrucianism and a lot of more occultic traditions concerning the use of the arts. And then book three is where things start getting really weird.
So, let's talk a little bit about kind of like the idea of conspiratainment and what you kind of mean by that.
Well, I think that, I mean, especially in the last, I would say, oh, maybe let's say since the 80s or so, you've really seen a major evolution in conspiracy circles. And I think it's sort of like marked a divide between what I would think of as more of a parapolitical approach that usually dominated more attempts at alternative history or fringe subjects in the immediate onset of the Cold War. And this is also true, I would say, of like ufology as well. For instance, a lot of the early ufologists tend to be more nuts and bolts types with former scientific backgrounds and so forth. And getting into the 1980s, I feel like you went through kind of the Bill Cooperization, if you will, of conspiracy culture, where it became almost more of like a kind of shock jock thing, where you were trying to come up with these more outlandish concepts. And then, kind of going all the way back to the late 60s, you had the introduction of Discordianism into it, and that started to become much more prevalent as well by the 1980s, to the extent that conspiracy theories were effectively being used as a kind of art form to create fiction, often with those being exposed to it unaware of this. So this has sort of turned into a garden industry over the years. I mean, certainly by the 90s, a lot of this was drifting into mainstream culture. You see it with the rise of things like the X-Files, for instance. And now, I mean, it really has become a kind of garden industry, if you will.
And so this is really laying the foundation of where we're at today, and like what all contributed to that with the growth of conspiratainment and how Psywar plays into all that.
Yeah, because again, also, you have to take into account the manipulations that have been done by various actors for the purposes of psychological warfare. And it's not always been government entities either. I mean, a big group that I focused on in this work was the Institute for American Strategy, which, even though it came out of conferences held that were sponsored by the National Security Council and the Pentagon, it was effectively a private agency that was using military-grade psychological warfare techniques to train political cadres in the United States. So you had, I mean, almost from the beginning as well, a lot of these powerful corporations and other private actors who were engaged in this, massive psychological warfare assault on the American public, effectively to inoculate us with a form of rather militant anti-communism. And they really did so by hook or by crook, if you will.
Well, let's talk about that. So you talk about two main agencies here. You talk about the ASC, American, was it
Security Council.
American Security Council, and the IAS that you just mentioned. And these two things, well, you talk about the IAS. So what is the American Security Council? How does this come in?
Well, the American Security Council was kind of contrary to what we had thought for a lot of years, more of an outgrowth of the IAS. But so a lot of this goes back to the mid-1950s and these conferences I was talking about. They were called the National Military Industrial Conferences, and they were sponsored by the National Security Council, the Pentagon, and a lot of major corporations involved in the defense industry, like Lockheed, Boeing, this kind of thing, Honeywell. And effectively, it was to come up with a form of political inoculation for both elites and the American public on the whole as we went into the glory days of the Cold War. So the IAS was really the psychological warfare bureau, if you will, that was developed to really test these techniques and develop them. And then the American Security Council was sort of the front group for this that really pushed a lot of this stuff at the grassroots level. It was originally had actually started out as sort of a glorified Pinkerton outfit. And then after it became involved with the IAS, it had essentially a joint function. So on the one hand, it provided security files for a lot of the same companies that were involved in the defense industry, so they were doing personnel checks and all this other kind of stuff. So it's, basically it's a myth in America that the blacklist only existed for a brief period of time in Hollywood and that type of thing. In point of fact, anybody who wants to work for a major corporation, especially one dealing in the defense industry in any real capacity, is going to be put through a security check. And during the heyday of the Cold War, it was institutions like the American Security Council that were tasked with compiling these dossiers on average American for the corporations. So this is a big part of what they did, and some of the sources they used for this were very controversial, to put it mildly. One was, I think his name was Harry Young, who was a veteran, labor buster going back to like the pre-World War II era. He had been affiliated with a lot of the native fascist movements in the United States in the lead up to the Second World War. So they were pulling these files from, it's to say, some pretty right-wing sources to begin with, the kind of people that saw anybody, to the left of Joseph McCarthy as being a dyed-in-the-wool communist, effectively. So this is part of what they were doing, and they compiled a lot of these dossiers. I mean, I think at the heyday around 1970, they had files on something like 4 or 5 million Americans, if I'm not mistaken. So this is a big part of what they did. And
And
then
these
on the other,
are, These are non-governmental organizations, because this really fits into what you're talking about, this network of coordination between, public and private, government, non-government, industry groups, groups representing these military industrial complex oriented companies. And so it's this like murky interface of this non-governmental, often secret world with the actual government.
And then it's, to even kind of further muddy the waters, like the original people behind the agency prior to the AIC, I think it was like called the Mid-Atlantic Research Group or something like that. But the top guy, and it was a dude named John Fisher, who was the longtime president of the ASC, and he was an ex-FBI guy, like a lot of the early executives with the American Security Council. And then another major partner with them in compiling these files for years was the American Legion, which, again, as I'm sure everybody listening to this knows, was a big veterans group. So you're essentially using a lot of like ex-FBI and military personnel to compile these dossiers in the first place. So that's kind of like another interesting thing about it, is it's, kind of this network of ex, military intelligence officers that are also being put to work in, basically this crypto form of blacklisting.
Kind of like deputizing these people and creating this kind of snitch culture.
Because again, you're the American Legion. Well, I mean, where are they getting some of this information from? I mean, a lot of it is like from Legion posts and stuff like that. I mean, people don't really realize, but they essentially were using the Legion effectively to monitor a lot of people, and then also Legion members. I mean, at the various factories and that kind of thing that they worked with. I mean, to monitor the conversations that their coworkers were having, all this other kind of stuff. So I mean, it was really insidious. And that was, kind of the more mundane, quote unquote, day-to-day stuff that the ASC was doing. Then on the other hand, they were effectively the major lobby group for the military industrial complex. So this was, consisted of a massive effort of public relations for the industry, supporting various wars and generally keeping the war machine running, if you will. And that was where a lot of the techniques that the IAS came into play, where you're applying these psychological warfare methods to drum home the necessity of the Cold War to the American public and supporting, any number of conflicts across the world during the heyday of the Cold War. There was a lot of stuff like that going on. And then to kind of go back to the Institute for American Strategy, another big factor with it, besides some of the techniques that it basically pioneered, such as fourth generational warfare. I mean, everybody thinks that was kind of a newer invention, but the head of the IAS, Frank Barnett, had developed essentially an identical concept called fourth dimensional warfare that they were training a lot of these political cadres at there was at the Freedom Studies Center, the college that the IAS had set up with the American Security Council. But anyway, another thing that Barnett and the IAS did that was really significant is he put together the donor network that launched the new right. This is Jane Mayer's whole, dark money thing, if you will. Barnett started out managing the funds for the Smith Richardson Foundation. Then later he became the major money manager for Richard Mellon Scafife's contributions, and then also with the Kors family. And he put together this donor network that became so integral going into the 1970s and launching the new right, and ultimately what became the Reagan Revolution. So that's another big legacy of this. It was both developing means of really promoting a much harder right-wing view to the American public on the one hand, while also putting together a network of funding to support it going into the latter years of the Cold War.
Because publicly facing both of these were presenting themselves as mostly policy groups. So for anyone who's not familiar with, you talked about the ASC a lot previously, but it's a good way to think about it is that it's the right wing counterpart to Council
Like the
Foreign
kid, yeah.
Relations. So basically anyone, seems like involved in any kind of influential position within foreign policy establishment or the military was usually either ASC or CFR, it seems like.
Yeah, they were kind of like counterbalances to one another, if you will. Though, I mean, I suppose in a sense you could say maybe the, well, I guess it would maybe be closer to like something like the Pilgrim Society, but sort of the older, more prestigious group behind the ASC and the IAS for that matter as well. And a lot of these other groups, like the John Birch Society, was the good old National Association of Manufacturers. I'm sure you guys have heard of
Oh.
that from Doc Future, but, you know,
Yeah, I
that.
was going to ask you what the influence was from the National Association of Manufacturers.
Well, NAM was a big part of putting together the National Military Industrial Conferences. And NAM, going back to the 30s and 40s, was huge in developing, you know, various public relations techniques to promote, really, I should say, more so to protect a lot of the major industrialists going into the Great Depression and so forth. So they were already, I mean, really studying a lot of these techniques of psychological warfare, and especially as it applies to more of a grassroots level. Because again, the National Association of Manufacturers was always the major counterbalance and rival of the New York-based groups like this Council on Foreign Relations and the Pilgrim Society. And these groups, the CFR and the Pilgrims, had a stranglehold on mainstream media from pretty much the beginning. They were very well acquainted with members of the New York Times and a lot of the other major journals. They had a lot of influence in Hollywood from very much the beginning and so forth. So they had a tremendous means of shaping popular culture through these mainstream institutions. So the National Association of Manufacturers had to really devise ways of disseminating their propaganda through the grassroots levels. This led them, you know, on the one hand, into embracing what were at the time, you know, somewhat revolutionary techniques like radio, which was a big thing for them. And it really laid the foundation for, you know, the later conservative radio bonanza going into the 80s with Rush Limbaugh. You sort of have like, what's his name? Clarence Manson is sort of the gap between these two eras. He was another figure big with the National Association of Manufacturers, early advocate of the John Birch Society, major conservative radio personality for years, and kind of the proto Rush Limbaugh, if you will.
Yeah,
So,
all of this stuff is like these seem like pioneering efforts that definitely bore fruit and kind of shaped like the entire what's now the establishment, right?
yeah, very much so. And I mean, NAM has always been, you know, the establishment, right? I mean, going all the way back. And again, it's not just these, you know, families like the Kochs or something like that that we think of. I mean, a major family behind the National Association of Manufacturers for years was the DuPont family. In fact, the records of the National Association of Manufacturers are actually at one of the DuPont personal collections in Delaware, remarkably. But Lamont DuPont and some of the other family members were just huge, huge contributors to NAM for years. So there were some really hefty American dynasties that were backing this for a good point, a good chunk of the 20th century, and probably still on some level.
Yeah, that's for sure. There is so you talk about in the book, there's a connection between these two groups and some other groups, but what is the association that you're drawing between these kind of mind control programs like MK Ultra, Artichoke, Bluebird, what have you, those type of programs?
Well, see, that was the other thing with the Institute for American Strategy, is they had individuals that were connected with MK Ultra, specifically James Monroe, Colonel James Monroe, who was the president for the Society for Investigation of Human Ecology. That was the funding conduit for MK Ultra. And from what I've been able to gather, there are strong indications that they were essentially trying to apply the techniques of MK Ultra to psychological warfare. Effectively, this was Naomi Klein's concept of the shock doctrine, if you will, where you could essentially induce a kind of fugue state into the subject where you could then reprogram their belief system or their ideology or something to that effect. And that's where I think conspiracy theories proved to be very fruitful for this approach to psychological warfare, because oftentimes when people do encounter this stuff, it can be absolutely earth-shattering to their worldview, especially, I mean, if you're encountering stuff that is a legitimate government scandal. I mean, for instance, CIA complicity in drug trafficking, for instance. I mean, there's really no question that this happened, now. I mean, anybody who denies this is delusional. I mean, there's so many compelling evidence of this now. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Both Southeast Asia and Central America.
I mean, absolutely. So, I mean, this is, just the kind of thing that, when you still had that more naive view of the US government at the security services, and you stumble onto something like that, I mean, it can be a little thing. But that's, the problem. I mean, on top of that, though, there's a lot of illegitimate research that goes into this that has the same kind of effect on people. And when you look at, especially again, since the kind of Bill Cooperization of conspiracy culture in the 80s, a lot of it has had kind of a hard right and or libertarian worldview to it. And arguably it's been used to subtly nudge people in that direction after they've been sort of lured into that fugue state from the initial shock, if you will.
Yeah, that's the reorientation phase in that framework, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I should point out too, it's not just, like a group like the John Birch Society that's doing this. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this, but like the Church of Scientology or Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, these guys are really invested in a lot of this New World Order style propaganda as well. I mean, for instance, Ezra Taft Benson, who was part of the Quorum, I believe, in the Mormon Church, was a really big advocate of a lot of like John Birch Society type literature during his heyday. And I mean, the Church of Scientology is also heavily used a lot of these kinds of conspiracy theories. So, you have these groups that maybe could be characterized in a certain sense as cults, they'll do respect, basically using some of this literature as a means to indoctrinate their members with. So, again, I know this is something that a lot of people in the quote unquote truth community or whatever want to live in denial of, but I mean, frankly, a lot of very suspect groups have been using your standard NWO type tracks for years as a way of, essentially indoctrinating their membership. So that should be really telling, especially in a post-Q world, if you will.
Yeah, it has a big relationship to, establishing an alternative worldview, and that can be a religion or a cult or anything like that.
Yeah.
So
What?
you are viewing conspiracy theory as an aspect of the art, like psychological warfare is, myth building, and the exploitation of superstition.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially because a lot of conspiracy theory is, in a sense, a kind of myth building. I mean, I think especially when you get into the more, kind of new agey or UFO centric ones, because in a lot of cases, this stuff is, well, I mean, frankly, it's really the same thing with like a lot of the, the hardline anti-communist or any Jewish conspiracy theories. I mean, essentially, all of these are trying to create this elaborate mythos of how human history, human governments have been manipulated by gray aliens or Jewish cabals or communist cabals or something to that effect, if you will. So, yeah, I mean, I do think that in a lot of ways, it is all, in a sense, an exercise in building a mythology. Which is certainly a major component of a any kind of serious movement, if you will.
And how does that relate to psychological warfare? And you mentioned this 1950 Rand report that really highlights, an early interest in exploiting superstitions and other things, like, would probably apply to something like conspiracy theory as well.
Well, I think the big figure with a lot of that was General Edward Lansdale, who really was the pioneer for America's approach to psychological warfare in a lot of different capacities into the Cold War. But Lansdale's big thing was the use of mythology to be weaponized for the purposes of psychological warfare. And he really pioneered this technique in the Philippines, which was the first significant counterinsurgency that the United States waged during the Cold War. And it was really the one that served as the foundation for later counterinsurgencies that we fought, such as in Vietnam, or we did so through proxies, such as through Project Condor or something to that effect. But anyway, getting back to Lansdale. So he's studying the Philippines. One of his major secondary officers, gosh, what was the guy? Charles Bohannon. He was actually a Smithsonian trained anthropologist. So this guy was very astute as well when it came to different indigenous mythologies. And they started looking at the Philippines and they came up with what Lansdale charitably referred to as a low humor approach to psychological warfare. So this consisted of rounding insurgents up, draining them of blood, and hanging them in trees, so that their fellow insurgents would believe that they had been killed by vampires, or recording a confession from an insurgent and then having it played back through loudspeakers from planes after that insurgent had turned up dead to try to convince the hooks that they were being haunted by the ghosts of this dead insurgent who was telling them how awful the afterlife was going to be for supporting the communist forces.
Which was
Or
reminiscent of what was going to later happen with Operation Phoenix with the one
yeah, the Warring
soul
Souls.
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, which was actually directly was directly an outgrowth of what they were doing with that in the Philippines. There they were using like helicopters and so forth. But yeah, it was the same exact principle. And by the time we got into Vietnam, like I was kind of shocked to see this, but this stuff had like literally been institutionalized into like psychological warfare manuals that they were giving out to army officers in Vietnam. So this was like the norm all the time already by the time we got to Vietnam, essentially. So we're already doing all this other kooky stuff, like painting Masonic all-seeing eyeballs on the doors of suspected insurgents, and then going into Vietnam, they took that like the next step with the death cards. So they had this belief, I guess, that if the third eye was mutilated, it would, in Vietnam, it would affect like the soul's reincarnation or something to that effect. So they would go through after they had killed insurgents and they would like literally nail death cards on their foreheads over the third eye,
Like the pineal gland.
the pineal gland, exactly, to play into that, superstitions. I mean, we were already doing all this kind of stuff by the Vietnam era. And as I started researching this more and more and saw just how heavily institutionalized it was in military doctrine, started to beg the question in my mind, well, would we have just done this overseas, or would we have stopped at doing it here, and we would have stopped here doing it domestically? And again, frankly, I don't think so. And going back to Lansdale, he was quite a student of the methods the communists used, and one of the major aspects that he embraced wholeheartedly was the concept of political cadres. And essentially, these are non-uniformed military officers that are going into the villages, essentially posing as villagers and this kind of thing to try and indoctrinate the inhabitants in communism. And he thought that we needed something like that here and within the army. And effectively, this is actually what civil affairs does in the military. A lot of people don't know that, but we actually have our own political cadres within civil affairs, which again are usually comprised of retired military officers that are used in these kind of quote unquote hearts and minds operations. But Lansdale long claimed that we needed full-blown political cadres in the United States that could work essentially as civilians while carrying out these psychological warfare operations.
And that sounds a lot like these networks that we're just talking about, connected to the ASC and the IAS.
Well, yeah, exactly, because Zansdell became involved with the Institute for American Strategy, and he helped set up that school that they had, the Freedom Studies Center. And this was based out of Virginia, not too far from DC. And effectively, they trained a lot of future new rights advocates at these schools, at this school. So, again, you're kind of left with the unsettling prospect that, I mean, a lot of the new right had been instructed in a lot of these military-grade psychological warfare techniques by people like Lansdale, or at least based on the same kind of stuff that he was doing overseas in the Philippines and then later in Vietnam. And in Lansdale's case, it's even more insidious, I think, because one of his biggest accolades towards the end of his official military career was Daniel Ellsberg. Going all the way back, up to like 2018, Ellsberg was still a fanatical devotee of Lansdale. I mean, when Max Boot interviewed him for his biography of Lansdale, he said that he loved Lansdale, that he was in the cult of Edward Lansdale. So Ellsberg becomes this huge figure in the anti-war movement after he comes back from Vietnam. He leaks the Pentagon Papers and all this other kind of stuff. And he ends up making it out to Hollywood, where he hooks up with this producer, Bert Schneider, who kind of cut his teeth as the visionary behind the Monkees, both the band and the TV series that was used to produce them. Then he did the film Head with Bob Rafelson, which Jack Nicholson wrote. And then effectively, they launched the modern American independent film industry with Easy Rider. And then a lot of the other films subsequently that Schneider produced back in this era, like Five Easy Pieces, The Last Picture Show, and all this other stuff. So,
The beginning of the new Hollywood.
exactly. But see, besides doing all of this, he's also sponsoring Ellsberg, but he's also sponsoring Huey Newton and the Black Panthers, a major financial contributor, and he's sponsoring the Yippies, Abbie Hoffman, and all these other people. So he's here working with Ellsberg, who was a good friend of his. In fact, he was one of his only real remaining friends going into the 90s when Bird had really fallen on hard times. And to my mind, this, again raises the question, well, Ellsberg, really was unabashed about his support of Lansdale, and he never broke off the relationship with Lansdale, even after he became a whistleblower. So, in theory, this is a way that the United States' premier psychological warfare officer could have been manipulating the new left as well as the new right
Well,
through a lot of these different institutions.
let me ask you this. I mean, I'm trying to kind of figure out the implication of Ellsberg. I mean, Ellsberg, best known, of course, for the Pentagon Papers. And you're right. Ellsberg is not someone that I norm when I think of a right winger. I don't think of Daniel Ellsberg. Quite the opposite. Was there some kind of operation going on with the Pentagon Papers? Was this something that was that some in Vietnam, maybe even some that were sympathetic to Lansdale, like you mentioned John Paul Vann, who of course is like the subject of a very famous book from the 80s about Vietnam, that possibility that he may have been the one to release the papers, but he dies. And
Yeah, Van was another guy who was really close to Ellsberg,
right.
too.
So, is there an implication here that, this could have been just some that this was released by people that might have been more in the know, in Vietnam?
Yeah, I think that that's very much the case. I mean, Lansdale is usually depicted as being very anti-Kennedy, but the more I looked into that, I actually think that that was more of a mythos that Lansdale himself had built up. He actually had pretty close relations with the Kennedys, and a lot of the Kennedy faction within the civilian government. So anyway, as it pertains to the Pentagon Papers, there is some pretty strong indications that because the Pentagon Papers were originally compiled during the LBJ presidency between, I think, like roughly like 66 and 67, 68, right?
Right.
And,
They had more to do. I mean, Nixon was worried about the Pentagon Papers, but they
but
had more.
yeah.
had way more to do with his predecessors than they actually did to him.
Yeah, exactly. So they were compiled during this era, and there was a thinking that the Kennedy loyalists in the White House were looking to leak them in 68 to force LBJ to step aside so that Robert Kennedy could get the nomination. Now, LBJ ended up taking the initiative and stepping aside anyway, and it seemed like, RFK was poised to get the nomination until he was assassinated. So from there, the Pentagon Papers kind of got rabbit holed for a couple of years. And it was really going into the early 70s when they started to leak out. And then it's kind of interesting, too, because this is sort of concurrent with Alfred McCoy starting to do his research into drug trafficking in Southeast Asia. Of course, he was the author of the famous The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, which was the first scholarly subject on CIA drug trafficking. And the guy who originally told him where to go in Laos to look into all this was Edward Lansdale and his cohorts like Lucien Cohen and so forth. So these guys were really starting, a lot of these officers with Lansdale and connect, or Lansdale himself and connected to him, were really starting to leak out a lot of this sensitive material going into the Nixon administration. I think that what triggered a lot of this is because Lansdale, even though he was more closely connected to the sort of liberal establishment, if you will, around the Council on Foreign Relations and the Kennedys, he despised Europe. He had spent pretty much all of his career in Asia, waging various wars there. And this was true of a lot of the officers around him. And I think a lot of them were felt profoundly betrayed by Nixon's pivot to China. Essentially the whole normalization of relations with Henry Kissinger started. And that really brought out the wrath of these guys. And to my mind, they were definitely working with other elements of the far right, i.e., the American Security Council, and trying to bring down Nixon as a result of essentially pursuing detente with China. Because this was huge back then. I mean, a major source of funding for the far right was the China lobby, which was largely centered around Taiwan. So Nixon's whole policy there was, again, it was seen as a major betrayal on the one hand by many elements of the far right, and then on the other hand by a lot of more liberal elements of the establishment, but those who had been very committed to US intervention in Asia. So a lot of people were pissed off at Nixon at that point around like the early 70s.
And this kind of fits into this whole Carl Oglesby Yankees versus Cowboys kind of thing, whereas this you have this Eastern establishment that's more Atlanticist oriented and internationalist, and then this like military industrial complex south west to west coast Asian oriented imperial, like you said, these guys had all these experience in these Asian wars, factions. So what you're talking about it are these, we may be seeing kind of the shadows of these internal factions battling it out with these leaks.
Yeah, and I mean that's really very much what was happening. I mean, essentially that's always been the purpose of leaks, if you really want to get down to it in DC. I mean, it's always a sign of some kind of interstate warfare between one group or other in DC. I mean, I take that back. I mean, there are also occasionally times when you have leaks essentially for the purposes of psychological warfare. I mean, recently, you had the, oh gosh, I think it was just a couple of days ago, the German government, Lee, or I should say the German military leaked essentially their future projections for a war with Russia, like in 2025 or something like that. In this case, they're basically trying to scare the hell out of the public to get them to continue financially supporting Ukraine. But more often than not, when you do have a leak, it's basically to air the dirty laundry of one side or another in some kind of internal squabble over policy.
While we're still on the periphery of Lansdale, you point out that when we think about these abuses of government agencies on the domestic population, we think of like, the CIA and things that came out in the Church Committee and things like that. But psychological warfare itself is operational and has more to do with the military. And Lansdale was an Air Force officer, and other military people were really involved through these private networks with, what you think was going on internally as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, another really big revelation for me when I was researching Lansdale was discovering that he was essentially the visionary behind the modern day Special Operations Command and the Joint Special Operations Command. A lot of his accolades were really responsible for setting that up during the 1980s. And again, this is within the special operations community. I mean, there are essentially three components of it. Of course, we all kind of know and love like the commando aspects of it, the Green Berets, the Delta Force, that kind of thing. But that's only one of the three branches. The other branches are the psychological warfare apparatus. And then there's the part that I was alluding to before, which is civil affairs, which essentially is kind of an extension, if you will, of psychological warfare, only using civilian cover effectively to carry it out. But this was all institutionalized into the conception of the Special Operations Command and the Joint Special Operations Command. And that's where you can see some just really mind-boggling kind of an overlap with some of these communities in recent years. I mean, just for instance, a major figure in setting up JSOC was Christopher Mellon. In fact, this is back when he was a congressional staffer, I think, for Sam Nunes, I think, who became a Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton. But at one point, they actually wanted to make him I can't remember what the name of the office is now, but it's the civilian who essentially oversees the Special Operations Command. I think it's like the Undersecretary of Defense for low intensity conflicts and covert operations or something like that. But Chris Mellon was supposed to be the inaugural guy to head all of this, but he turned it down. But he would continue to work in a lot of this stuff in the Pentagon, including information warfare, all the way up through the late 90s. And for those of you unaware, Chris Mellon in the last couple of years became a really big figure in the UFO disclosure initiatives. He was one of the major guys behind Tom DeLonge's To the Stars Academy. I know he's broken with him in recent years, but I mean, he's been a big figure pushing a lot of disclosure stuff. So, yeah, it's really interesting that he went from setting up the Joint Special Operations Command, overseeing information warfare in the Pentagon, to becoming an advocate for disclosure for UFOs.
Yeah, just as an aside, you talk about in the book, you talk about the JSOC command. I don't know if you heard our interview that we did with JSOC, the SOCOM, some of the guys that were in there in Vietnam that were basically, a part of this whole group, and they were going behind the enemy lines. They were part of JSOC under Singlaub. But one of those guys, was guest Drew Hurst Beeson that I had on, he suspects that one of those guys was actually D.B. Cooper. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
I've
Possibly.
never heard that, but that would not surprise me. I mean, a lot of the guys, I mean, this would have, yeah, probably been kind of, if it was Singlaub, it would have been, actually, it might have been tied up with Phoenix, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember he was operating in, I think it was Phoenix, though, that he was operating in at that point in time.
It was all part. Yeah, it was all part of that.
Guys who are good at jumping out of planes.
Well, he was actually one of the pioneers, yeah, of like the plane jump
They were
stops and
real
just.
good about jumping out of planes.
That's where they get the airborne shit from, you know?
Let's back up a little bit with not Ellsberg, but with Lansdale. I do want to hit something else about Ellsberg here in a little bit, but Lansdale was also suspected of being involved with some of this drug trafficking in Southeast Asia. And he had all these kind of, when he gets over there, I mean, he's very much the man. I mean, he's helping to set up GM's government in South Vietnam. And he is also has all these connections with all these kind of weird, religious groups that are in Vietnam. Can you go over some of that?
Yeah, it really was all kind of like the lead up to the Battle of Saigon, which was just crazy. But okay, so when he got into Vietnam, essentially the situation is the French were managing the territory that they controlled largely through these three separate cults slash crime syndicates. Gosh, I can't remember the names of them off the top of my head, but they were effectively all funded in some capacity or other through drug trafficking. At least one of them was basically a crime syndicate, and the other two, I think it was like the Cao Dao, if I'm not mistaken, and I can't remember the other one. But they were essentially cults. They had pretty considerable sizes in the countryside, so they did have a fair amount of membership, and they also all had their own militaries effectively, and these were essentially the irregulars that supplemented the French military, if you will. So when Lansdale gets in there, he starts pitting these different groups of war with each other in a bid to essentially to cut the French out of the drug trade, because he knew if he could break their hold on the heroin racket there, the French basically would be screwed and they would have to formally withdraw from Vietnam permanently. And this touched off what became known as the Battle of Saigon. And it was more or less, I mean, frankly, an open gang war or something to that effect. I mean, I know at one point, Lansdale had like sat down with the French commissioners and all of the military journalists, or I mean, all the military officers and so forth. This was like after I think the Battle of Saigon was over with, but they had still made several attempts to assassinate a few members of his team and so forth. And he told them that he was going to withdraw his protection from them from this point going forward. And they asked him what that meant, and he said, "You'll see." And that night, essentially, he had Lucien Cohen and other members of his team drive by the French embassy and open up with machine guns and throw grenades and so forth into it. And I mean, it was basically like a drive-by shooting, more or less. Anyway, after that, the French threw in the white towel, so to speak. But yeah, I mean, it was nuts. It was really almost, like I said before, I mean, an open gang warfare that Lansdale was fighting between himself and the French there. And I mean, when he was sent back to Vietnam in the mid-60s, he had.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To essentially square things with what was the Corsican Brotherhood, the French mafia there, because they were kind of worried that he was going to get back into muscling into their territory and maybe setting up like a rival drug lord or something. And through Lucien Cohen, who was sort of regarded as his concierge with the drug trade, he had to assure them that he wasn't interested in that this time around. But yeah, he was definitely a guy who had a lot of influence on the early use of the drug trade to sponsor a lot of these covert operations.
He seemed to have his hands in a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, that was like kind of one of the things that was most shocking to me working on this book, because I think originally I had kind of thought, oh, I'm going to write maybe a couple of paragraphs about Lansdale because he's big in psychological warfare, so I got to cover him. And then the more I started researching this guy, it just kind of grew and grew. Eventually, I ended up flying out to San Francisco so I could go to Hoover to even go through his papers and whatnot. But I mean, he did essentially become really, I think, the main character in this book, if you will. So he grew from just sort of this, almost like footnote into being a huge presence throughout the whole first book.
Let's
Well,
talk a little bit of.
go ahead, Adam.
Well, I want. Well, Surfiel, if there's something that you wanted to add to that, or.
I think if you want to say anything else before we pivot into more of this woo stuff, UFOs, New Age movement, and how this all relates, but. Do you want to cover anything else before that, Adam?
Well, yeah, I was thinking about the John Birch Society stuff,
Oh yeah,
which
we haven't even touched that yet.
I know you're going to cover in another book, but it seems like you did touch a little bit on the John Birch Society and some of its influence and some of its connections to all this.
Well, I mean, again, I definitely think that the John Birch Society was part of this psychological offensive by the Institute for American Strategy. And there was never really a direct link, but as I had talked about before, both of these groups really grew out of the milieu of the National Association of Manufacturers. And it was really explicit with JBS. Robert Welch had been a senior figure in the National Association of Manufacturers. He had distributed a lot of Robert Welch, by the way, for those of you unfamiliar, was the founder and longtime president of the JBS. But he had started out with his political advocacy in the National Association of Manufacturers. He had distributed most of his early anti-communist literature through the National Association of Manufacturers. And I think something like five of the six or five of the 11 or 12 founding members of the JBS were not just members of the National Association of Manufacturers, but they were former presidents of the National Association of Manufacturers. You had other former NAM presidents like Roger Milliken, joined the JBS for after a time. So there was a tremendous overlap between the JBS and the National Association of Manufacturers. And then, as it pertained to the Institute for American Strategy, one of the major figures in the IAS for years was Henry Regnery, the founder of Regnery Press, which was a big conservative publishing house that famously issued William Buckley's Man, God, and Yale, and a lot of those kind of quote unquote classics. But Regnery was a senior member of the board of the Institute for American Strategy, and was both a good friend of Robert Welch and a business partner of him. Robert Welch was actually a major shareholder in Regnery Press. And Regnery had released, or I should say, published a lot of Welch's early anti-communist tracts as well. And Welch continued to be a significant shareholder in Regnery up through, I think, at least the early 70s. So there was a lot of this overlapping membership and also corporate ownership between these different groups. And for the JBS, for me at least, one of the things that was really shocking and working on this book was uncovering just the concern that a lot of people had about the conspiracy theories that JBS was issuing in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination, because they were really, really pushing the narrative that it was Castro and the Soviets who were behind the Kennedy assassination, and that the US government had been co-opted by the communists and was trying to cover this up. Now, a lot of people kind of forget this, but the Warren Commission, a big part of why we actually had the Warren Commission in the first place, and don't get me wrong, the Warren Commission is disinformation, but it was started to counter the disinformation that was being issued by the John Birch Society. And it's really incredible because the Pentagon had this elaborate plan for a preemptive first strike, basically, the onset of nuclear war against the Soviet Union during the late and towards the end of 1963. And going into 64, they were really angling for a preemptive strike against the People's Republic of China to help our efforts in Vietnam. So I see the John Birch Society, with its ties to the military through this kind of overlap with the IAS and these other groups, as a ploy to try to basically whip the public into a fury to where a nuclear exchange would be acceptable. And then, conversely, from the CFR crowd and these other people, there was a counter propaganda blitz. I mean, this was something I got into with my Kubrick presentation, but I very much see some of these films like Dr. Strangelove, which came out, was actually supposed to come out November 22nd, 1963. Because of what happened on that day, to get pushed back to early January. But I mean, it was definitely very much, I think, a part of this counteroffensive. And then you can throw in something like 7 Days in May and some of these other films that were coming out at that time as well.
Which I just watched for the first time last night, by the way.
Yeah, it's freaking good, man. It's
Yeah.
very underrated. John Frankenheimer, man, some really interesting stuff he was doing in that whole era, as well as Kubrick.
Which Manchurian Candidate was another one of his films.
And
Yeah.
Seconds too. That's another one that I think was really pivotal in a lot of this too. But you know, it's just fascinating. Again, kind of going back to what I was saying with the CFR and the National Association of Manufacturers. So the CFR has all of your kind of mainstream media outlets, and NAM is doing this grassroots stuff, and you really see the end results of that playing out with the Kennedy assassination, where there's sort of this battle for the narrative being waged on the one hand through Hollywood, and then on the other hand through these groups like the John Birch Society. I mean, to me, this is another layer of the Kennedy assassination, even looking beyond what actually happened, who was behind it, that kind of thing. It's just utterly fascinating on a lot of levels. And I mean, how this really was so crucial to the destiny of America, because if one side had won out here, I mean, you know, the world we live in now would probably be quite different, to put it mildly.
That's for sure.
Well, you talk about some a little bit about the JBS stuff, about how they got obsessed with the Illuminati.
Yeah.
And I know you're going to go into that more, but the, in another, I think in the second volume. But you know, I mean, this is one of the interesting things that they got kind of obsessed with that, and how
Yeah,
that all starts.
they were the ones who really revived a lot of the Illuminati conspiracy theories, but just for the purposes of what we've been discussing here, why that's really significant. So, up until I think it was like 65 or 66 when Welch started invoking the Bavarian Illuminati, but like up to that point, a lot of the stuff that he was putting out, it was, you know, I mean, it was over the top, but I mean, most of it was reasonably plausible. Okay. I mean, again, it was the distortion of a lot of the facts and so forth. But, you know, if you go back and you look at the Bolshevik Revolution, you know, it's definitely true that Wall Street was enabling the Bolsheviks at some points. Now, they had their own agendas for doing that. But if you manipulate some of this stuff in a certain way, you can create a plausible scenario for how communists had infiltrated the government. But when he started invoking the Bavarian Illuminati, pretty much all plausibility was thrown out the window. Now it's just starting to become increasingly more and more absurd. And that, incidentally, coincided with the collapse of JBS membership in the same era, too. And this is, you know, again, they were at their pinnacle of their influence around 64, 65. I mean, they were
Yeah.
huge and getting Goldwater, the Republican nomination. They were crucial to that. They had a lot of political clout at this point when Welch started talking about the Illuminati. So personally, I think that people were so concerned with the saber rattling, what might have happened if some of the more radical elements of the Pentagon had gotten their way and gotten that nuclear exchange, that Welch was told to take a dive. You know, you need to start talking about something ridiculous now, dude. And that
Well,
was
you might
what.
have actually totally believed it too. I mean, there's that possibility.
There's that possibility, but he never even really brought up any of that stuff. I mean, maybe they might have had somebody convince him of it or something, but it seems really convenient that he brought that out at the pinnacle of their influence and basically destroyed the organization's credibility at a time when they had arguably become a real threat to world peace, to put it mildly.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, after 64, the Goldwater is defeated. I mean, it does seem like they probably reduce in membership, but it seems like it would be natural in an election year like that, that people would flock to them, and then the guy is defeated, and then it kind of like
Well,
it
no,
kind of starts to decline.
actually their membership was still high up through 65, up to about 66 when the
Yeah.
Illuminati stuff. So no, it didn't. That's another thing. It did not taper off after Goldwater lost. again, that kind of goes back into the whole, when cults fail scenario. I mean, a lot of times, actually, when doomsday prophecies don't pan out, it actually brings together the core membership even more so in the fanaticism.
And a lot of people don't realize too that JPS is still around. They are still actually around as an organization. It's just that their thunder has been taken by a lot of different areas. And I think that that was, I
Well,
think
yeah,
that
I mean,
was
Welch is absolutely passé compared to Bill Cooper or Alex Jones. I mean, let's not kid ourselves.
Which, by the way, if you if whenever you get a sugar daddy, sugar babies, or junior mints, you can think of Robert Welch.
Yes, good old candy manufacturer.
So if you go to the
Candyman.
movie theater and get some sugar babies, think about virulent anti-communism.
Think about your precious bodily fluids.
Yes, exactly. Well, I would like to we'd like to touch a little bit about the U about the influence on ufology. And there is one interesting link that I found really fascinating, which was Jacques Vallée's connection to a lot of this. We're going to bring Jacques Vallée into the conspiracy, guys.
No, it was interesting because I found out that a lot of Vallée's earlier works were actually published by Regnery, along with some stuff by Jacques Lesberger and a few of these others. And so this in and of itself is weird because Regnery, as I'd said before, was pretty much only exclusively interested in publishing right-wing tracts, essentially. These were guys pushing people like William Buckley. So not only are they publishing these UFO books, but I mean, this is, again, like in the late 60s, early 70s, they're not even publishing like nuts and bolts type UFO books. They're publishing this really like woo-woo mystical UFO ufology that Vallée and Hynek were pushing. And then also Berger had kind of gone in with that as well, which
Well,
to me,
Hynek, I think, had been convinced by Vallée that, there was a lot more going on than.
yeah, they published, I think, the 75 book that Vallée and Hynek co-authored together. I can't remember the name of it
Think
now,
it was
but that
like
was,
Dimensions or something like that.
yeah, I
They
don't think it was Dimensions, but it was, oh, gosh, I can't remember right now, but it was at the point when Hynek had started to go in more for the sort of like interdimensional, hypothesis more so than like the nuts and bolts stuff. But yeah, it was just really interesting that this was the specific brand of ufology that they chose to embrace the time when this was definitely a distinctly minority opinion. It's only really been in the last couple of years that I think the sort of, I guess, quote unquote, ultra dimensional, interdimensional, whatever, or ultra terrestrial hypothesis has started to gain a lot of currency amongst ufologists. Because for many years, it was always the kind of nuts and bolts physical explanations that were put out there.
Yeah, it's been getting a lot of press now recently. I mean, I think since people like Diana Pasulka, religious studies professors have started really moving into this and have found an interest in it.
But I mean,
What?
I think that it
Yeah, go
makes
ahead.
sense. I mean, I think it makes sense a lot more from the perspective of Lansdale as well, and just the use, the attempts to try to weaponize mythology, because this really was taking UFOs into a, a very spiritual or even religious directions, essentially. And I think that that has to be given as a serious possibility, because the other thing about Vallée that's interesting with him being published by Regnery about around this time, i.e., the mid 60s, early 70s, is this is essentially the time when the Soviet Union is also going through its kind of proverbial age of Aquarius, if you will. And they've really started to embrace the whole ancient astronauts hypothesis well before Chariots of the Gods starts to gain traction in the West. They were starting to look into this back in the late 50s as state policy, because again, theoretically, there's supposed to be an atheistic regime. So, okay, all of this mystical woo-woo stuff in the Bible. Well, Jesus was actually a physical alien from Zeta Reticula. So you got all that cleared now. It's all just science stuff that has nothing to do with spirituality. It makes total sense, the certain branch of the Soviets. And it also plays into older traditions of Soviet cosmos and that kind of ideology, cosmos, and because this stuff was so thoroughly ingrained in their scientific community, going all the way back to the early days of the Soviet Union. And for those of you unfamiliar with the Russian cosmatists, this was almost a kind of proto-transhumanist ideology that started to emerge first in the Russian Empire around the turn of the 20th century, and then in the early Soviet Union. And it was obsessed with space exploration, with life extension, with a lot of this other kind of stuff. But also, some of the cosmos were really taken with ESP and things like that as well. But as a movement, it was kind of natural that they would drift into ufology. And they started to make a real resurgence after Stalin's death, kind of going into the 60s. And this is the same time when the Soviet Union started to really formally embark upon ESP research and all this other kind of stuff again. So you had this very kind of proto New Agey air unfolding in the Soviet Union at this point in time. So Vallée's theories, even though they were really woo-woo over here, they started to gain some traction with some Soviet ufologists, and he had opened up a dialogue with them going into the mid-1960s. And this had led to a really peculiar incident when the Russian Air Authority had started to open itself up to reports of UFOs from the Soviet citizens. And this is really interesting because for many years, Rand and a lot of these other think tanks had been obsessed with how UFO reports would affect American air defense measures, especially if we had an exchange with the Soviet Union, because it could be a real issue, but not as much as it would be to the Russians, because we didn't have a total top-down form of command. We had a much more decentralized command, which made our responses more flexible. But the Soviets, everything had to be approved in the upper levels. So what would happen if they opened themselves up to UFO reports? Well, they found out in 1967. Their air defense was completely overwhelmed for, I think, the 24 hours that they allowed UFO reports. So what that means effectively is the United States could have launched a preemptive strike there, and the Soviet air defense would have been totally powerless to mount any kind of countermeasure towards it. They would have probably been totally wiped out in the exchange. So, to my mind, it's absolutely insane to think that the US intelligence community would not be interested in how something like that would affect the Soviet Union. And I have the absolute highest opinion of Jacques Vallée. I don't think that he was ever necessarily a conscious agent for something like this. But do I think that he could have been nudged to try to push this to his counterparts in the Soviet Union because certain figures in the security services were curious to see what would happen? Absolutely. And I'm sure that they would have been pleased with the results of what happened with that. Suffice to say, the Soviet Union put the kibosh on the UFO reports after that.
So, in addition to the utility of ufology and things like, finding these gaps in the, chainmail of the Russian materialism, you think psi might have served a similar purpose in psi research?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, and just more broadly speaking, the human potential movement, because again, I don't think that it's ever really been seriously considered as how this worked as a form of psychological warfare against the Russians, even though by the late 1980s, you have Gorbachev doing the famous hot tub diplomacy at Esalen, right? But again, going back to Russian cosmism, this was a really big ideology within the Soviet scientific community, and this helped coin the sort of concept that we now think of as the noosphere. Desjardins, of course, played a big role in this, but also there were a lot of the Soviet cosmonists. I know there's one guy specifically, I can't remember his name now, but this was really big in the Soviet Union. The Gnosisphere stuff really didn't start to catch on in the United States until the 60s and 70s, and it's always been kind of confined to like the New Age community, if you will. Barbara Marx Hubbard, for instance, was who was also Daniel Ellsberg's sister-in-law, was a really big proponent of this kind of stuff. But in the Soviet Union, it was practically an article of faith for elements of the scientific community and increasingly some of the technocratic components of the state. So even though theoretically the Soviet Union was an atheistic country, this did provide a kind of covert form of spirituality in a lot of these circles. And once again, it kind of begs the question, well, would we have tried to exploit that? When you look at the development of the New Age movement, when you see a person like Barbara Marx Hubbard, who again was used to establish ties with a lot of her counterparts in the Soviet Union while simultaneously working in the what was it, the Task Force Delta thing with John Alexander and the Pentagon in the 1980s, along with her, again, her in-law Daniel Ellsberg, it raises a lot of interesting questions about what might have been going on with some of these players.
Yeah, so that was what I kind of wanted to circle too, was Ellsberg. He had a lot of interesting New Age kind of beliefs himself, and like some ideas that he things that he liked to do.
I mean, he was kind of around the Essling crowd in the early days too. I was actually kind of
Right.
surprised to learn also that he had been involved with psychedelics going back to the very early 60s. In fact, he had actually been dosed through like a study at Rand, and then also through gosh, I can't remember the doctor now. He's one of the early LSD doctors in LA. He was the guy who had given LSD to like Cary Grant, a lot of these other famous people. But yeah, I mean, that's also why it's kind of absurd when you get into the 70s and like the Watergate plumbers are talking about how they're going to dose Daniel Ellsberg to try to discredit him in public or something. It's like Ellsberg had been tripping for like over a decade at that point.
Right.
It's just like, he's gonna be like, oh, okay, I'm tripping
Right.
again. I mean, like, it's again, like when you kind of look at the theater of some of this stuff. But yeah, I mean, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Steven.
But yeah, Ellsberg had been involved in the early psychedelic community. I think actually his wife, Patricia Ellsberg, this was Barbara's sister, was probably even more involved in some of this New Age stuff and that kind of thing. But yeah, Ellsberg was kind of tied into all of this as well. So, I mean, again, this is another, sort of aspect of the new left that you can kind of look to and see where some of these psychological warfare measures have potentially reached into. Because again, Ellsberg did have a lot of connections to the psychedelic, kind of the head scene on the one hand, and then through his sister-in-law and his wife, a lot of figures that were key figures in the New Age movement as well. So it's it's a very disturbing set of circumstances when you kind of step back and like look at the bigger picture of this stuff.
One of the things that I found interesting, and it was just something that you mentioned in one of the in one of the paragraphs. It was they were talking about they wanted to push even in the 70s, they wanted to push the Strategic Defense Initiative. So Star Wars, basically the weaponization of space, and a group that they. That these guys in this think tank were trying to were getting to promote this was the Church Universal and Triumphant, which was Elizabeth Clare Prophet's group. And I just thought that is, but that takes me back something that I've mentioned several times on the show. That's a connection to, Michael Flynn and, him basically paraphrasing, completely ripping off, really, the prayer that he did at the QAnon, which he got from the QAnon conference that he got from basically verbatim from Elizabeth Clare Prophet. So I thought that that was an interesting connection.
Yeah, no, it was actually the American Security Council. I think they had General Daniel Graham, who had actually gone to speak at some of the Church of Universal Triumphant conferences or something like that back in the late 1980s when he was trying to drum up support for the Strategic Defense Initiative. But yeah, I mean, and this is again where, in some senses, the UFO community, I think, was very useful to this because there was this whole narrative that was kind of put out for during the 80s and then for years afterwards, like through, Colonel Philip J. Corso, for instance, in the day after Roswell, where, the actual purpose of the Strategic Defense Initiative is it was to protect us from an invasion from hostile aliens. It wasn't really to weaponize space to terrorize the public down here. It was protect us from the aliens, but we can't tell people that. So
And you have that weird quote from, well, Reagan said something when he was president about, it's it,
yeah, was it
what
oftentimes I think it would be easier if we faced an alien invasion or an invasion from space or something like that.
But then
yeah
there's
and
super practical applications like just the overwhelming of UFO reports could, damage the defensive systems of the air commands of, either country, which were integral to nuclear war.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of factors to where you had to kind of carefully manage the UFO community. So, it could essentially be a benefit to the security services because, on top of everything else, I mean, the Soviets were also very interested in our domestic UFO community because, again, I suspect that a fair amount of UFO reports, I mean, not a ton of them, but at least a decent amount of them. Are probably of classified weapon systems that were,
Oh,
testing
yeah,
out and
of
things like
course.
that. So, once again, I mean, you would be foolish to think that the Soviets wouldn't be interested in this. I mean, sign up for a couple of UFO groups and monitor these reports. I mean, it's a real easy way to gather intelligence in that sense. So you can kind of sort of see why they might have been concerned about, like, Paul Benowitz, for instance. I mean, he was the New Mexico ufologist that Richard Doty and all of these people around the aviary effectively drove insane. But again, if he was, potentially filming classified weapons, you can at least understand why initially they might have been concerned about that. You can question why how they approached their methods for countering him for doing that, but at least you can understand why they might have had an issue with it.
Yeah, I think in Magic Men, they talk about
You mean Mirage Man?
Mirage Men. Yeah, thank you. In Mirage Men, they talk about how basically that what he was filming was drones, essentially early drone technology, and this is something the late 70s, early 80s that they were starting to work on, and that was completely secret at that time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that would probably be the most plausible explanation. But then again, I mean, it doesn't entirely make sense though, because by all accounts, Benowitz was pretty right wing. I mean, he was a really patriotic type. So you kind of wonder, like, couldn't somebody from the Air Force have just gone to him and said, "Oh, that's it's not UFOs. That's classified
Well,
weapons you're filming. Can you just
yeah.
stop it, please?"
Well, I think part of the purpose with Benowitz was to create a narrative.
Yes, I mean, I think it
I
was.
think it was basically on Doty's part, and probably the FOZ was, let's see what we can get away with. Let's see what narrative we can create. And it really did create a narrative.
Yeah, because this was definitely at a time when Doty was seeding a lot of these different narratives. It wasn't just Benowitz. I mean, he's also,
Linda Moulton Howe was another one that he tried to,
And the authors too about behind the first Roswell books. Shoot, I can't remember the main guy's name now off the top of my head. They also wrote the book on the Philadelphia experiment.
more, more,
Bill Moore, correct. But yeah, this is at a point in time when they were really going all out to kind of seed this mythos into the American public. And this also, I mean, I think contributed to really the rise of conspiratainment because it became this increasingly absurd narrative, when especially when you started getting into the, the deep underground bases. I mean, by the, the late 80s, early 90s, it's gotten to the point where what the gray aliens have taken over the Dulce base, and the
Well,
Delta Force is being sent down there to have
yeah,
wars
the
with
Phil
them.
Schneider stuff. And I mean, really, I mean, it even spawns a TV special. I mean, it spawns a UFO cover-up live. But all that mythology was wrapped up into the X-Files later on.
Yeah, it was. It
That's where all
was.
the X-Files mythology comes from, is all that stuff in the 80s.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, that was kind of the accumulation, I think, of this really turning into a full-blown pop culture phenomenon. It really was through the X-Files, and a
So, in
lot of
addition
the.
to conspiratainment really coming into its own in the 80s, you also talk about how JSOC and SOCOM really, come to prominence. And this was all due to a lot of these efforts that we've been exploring from, the previous century.
Yeah, I mean, as I talked about before, I mean, it was a lot of these accolades with Edward Lansdale, and it was even people like Christopher Mellon. The guy's been so big in UFO disclosure, but I mean, also a member of the fabulously wealthy and powerful Mellon family of Pittsburgh. So yeah, I mean, it really was a accumulation of a lot of these different vested interests, especially, coming in the aftermath of both the experiences in Vietnam and the Church Committee. On the one hand, this had resulted in the CIA getting kind of slapped on the wrist here and there. It was a little difficult for it to manage covert operations quite the way it had during the good old days. And then on the other hand, the limitations of the CIA, I think, had really been exposed when trying to manage something like the Phoenix program. Because it's, again, the CIA does a lot of stuff really well, but it's not really designed to try to manage a counterinsurgency across an entire country like Vietnam. You really need the military to do something like that, because the CIA just doesn't have the personnel, quite frankly, to manage something like that for an extended period of time. I mean, they've always been more reliant on, kind of mercenary forces. They don't have an especially large detachment of, qualified military officers that can do that kind of stuff. And even in those cases, they frequently had to be supplemented by the special forces community within the military. So it kind of became obvious increasingly to a lot of people going into the 80s that, you just needed to kind of cut out the middleman, if you will. And that really came to fruition during the Bush 2 presidency. And again, that's probably led to a lot of the issues that we've had in recent years. I mean, a lot of these people like Flynn, McChrystal, I mean, all came out of that kind of culture around JSOC. So there you go.
I mean, you can draw, you could, I think you could draw a straight line between somebody like Michael Flynn and Lansdale. I mean, just in like ideas
Oh,
and
yeah. The,
techniques.
yeah. I mean, different approaches and so forth. And I mean, yeah, it's quite a rabbit hole with all of that. And I mean, I don't think we've seen the last of it at all, certainly with the current election we've got looming here in 2024.
We sometimes try to avoid current events, but I'm real curious of where you think this is all, where it's all going this year, Stephen. Probably the only person I haven't talked to about this.
Well, I mean, I think it's going to be absolutely insane. There's no question. I mean, I could see
I mean,
all
we
kinds.
saw we're recording this on the 16th, the evening of the 16th, but the Iowa caucus was just last night, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious things are going to be absolutely no holds barred with this. And I mean, I think it's just because, again, a lot of these different groups that we've been kind of outlining throughout all of this are just, they're becoming increasingly desperate right now. And I think for the Democratic establishment especially, I mean, the support of the Biden administration for Israel has just been an absolute disaster. And I mean, again, I think a lot of people have already been, becoming increasingly disillusioned with Biden leading up to this, but just the perpetual support for Ukraine now coupled with what's happening in Israel, and just, I mean, what could potentially where we could be going from this. I mean, you're now seeing escalations with the Houthis in Yemen and all this other stuff kind of playing out as well. I mean, as we're recording this, the US has just started to engage in airstrikes in Yemen. I mean, this is just an absolute powder keg. I know that people have been kind of dismissing the stuff when the military was floating around the prospect of reviving the draft, but I think that that should probably be taken more seriously than a lot of people are. We're getting into that kind of environment right now.
And this kind of like
Wow.
the ascendancy of the conspiratainment with this real time interaction with political actors that we see now in this like hyper method. I mean, that's going to be insane. It gets crazier every year. And this election cycle, like to see that relationship is going to be crazy.
Well, I mean, more broadly speaking, though, I mean, it's like what's really happened with like this with online culture, especially I think for Generation Z. I mean, this is something I've been doing some shows on lately, but when you sort of look at like some of the gamer subcultures and things that have grown out of that, especially with some of the infiltration by groups like the Order of the Nine Angles, the Temple of Blood, and some of the more obscure ones. So you have this whole almost like subculture of like grooming that's been done on a massive scale where these kids are, just going into like gamer chats and stuff, and they're randomly being exposed to child pornography or these other kinds of extreme porn. They're being groomed into torturing animals and things like that. They're being coerced into posting nude photos of them stuff, things like that. These kids are seeing other individuals commit suicide online, just this whole sort of grotesque subculture that's grown out of the chans. And you got to think about this, right? So we kind of know now
It's interesting.
there's a, well, there's a certain formula, right? For, well, I shouldn't say formula, but there's a lot of common characteristics that a lot of serial killers share, including exposure to pornography and war pornography at young ages, killing and torturing animals, which is the kind of stuff right now that a lot of people are being pushed to embrace, not just in a kind of an individualized scale, but a really massive scale. So you got to kind of wonder, why would you want to try to groom almost an entire generation into sociopaths? And the one really logical explanation I can think for that is you want to get a younger generation on war footing.
That's pretty strong, man. That's that's
Well,
pretty
that's where we're
worrying.
heading, unfortunately.
Well, I just going to reiterate that I really do think that this next year, well, this year now is just going to be crazy.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot at stake, no doubt. And I mean, frankly, I think we're screwed regardless of who wins. I mean, I think that's the only real projection we can say with any kind of accuracy, unfortunately.
Well, I think we're probably more screwed if others if Trump wins, by my personal opinion, but it might depend how you look at things, I guess. It just seems to me that with Biden and everything, we've just gone back to like this kind of weird business as usual kind of way, and it's just not really working.
Yeah, they're
Only that we're
hot.
falling only that we're falling into like wars left and right
Right.
here.
And it's well, that's business as usual. So it just seems like that's going to be the biggest thing, is going to be that. That will be the biggest thing that we'll get to. I think we'll get Trump back in office,
And I mean,
honestly.
I will say this. I mean, I absolutely despise Trump with every fiber of my being, but I think Trump at least is not insane enough to think that the United States can wage all of these different wars on the same front. That is the one saving grace that I think that he has versus what I don't even know if it's Biden at this point. I mean, does anybody even really think that he's running the country at this point? But I mean, the group around the State Department, Blinken, Nuland, I mean,
Yeah,
this
they're
is the
technocrats.
same. Yeah, these are the same group. I mean, Nuland is married to freaking Robert Kagan. I mean, these are the same psychopaths that drove the Bush 2 administration. I mean, let's not kid ourselves here. These people are insane.
Well, we really just Yeah, I don't know. I what I'm hoping is that World War III doesn't break out. I don't think that that's what's going to happen, but I think it's going to increase much more the popularity of the
It's
idea
yeah.
of America first is what it's going to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, and then on the other hand, I mean, I think there's also potential prospects of a civil war of some kind breaking out too. I mean, there's just a lot of minefields. I mean, I could see
Well, that's
basically.
what we're saving that for 2025.
I mean, I think that that's, essentially where you could sort of look at the two paths that we're faced with here,
Right. Yeah, that's a
where,
good way of looking at it.
you go with Biden, you're potentially looking at World War III. If Trump prevails, I mean, I think there's a good chance that the different factions in the security services will plunge the country into a full-blown civil war. So, I mean, it's not a great situation either way, to put it mildly.
Or a little combination of both in either outcome.
Yeah,
And it's
absolutely.
weird because there's a movie coming out about an American, an updated
Yeah,
Civil
great,
War.
great timing.
Yeah, for real.
Oh, what, they're remaking Red Dawn?
No, it's
They already
called
remade
Civil
that.
War, I think.
It's
It's
called
a
Civil
big
War.
budget,
Okay.
Just what we need.
Right.
What can we expect from book two, and what kind of timeline we got on there?
Well, I'm hoping to start on book two by the summer, ideally. I'm actually working on a Kubrick book right now. I'm putting together some of the lectures I did for you and some of the
Cool.
other stuff that I've been doing. So I'm hoping to get that finished in the next couple of months here and then
Yeah,
get
anyone
ready
who
for book
saw
two.
last year's Strange Realities conference and Stephen's presentation probably got a preview of that material.
Right.
Oh yeah. And I mean, I kind of think too that it's really related to a lot of the stuff that I'm getting into because I mean the art tends to focus more on how like fringe cultures have been manipulated. But as I was sort of talking about before, I think Kubrick was sort of part of this response against the JBS. So he's kind of indicative of how some of the stuff has played out in more mainstream circles. So really excited with that. Hoping to, like I said, get that knocked out in the next couple of months. And then hopefully around maybe June, July, I can start working on book two. I don't know how long that will take because, like I said, it's going to require a lot of heavy research, but I'm hoping I can get it out maybe early 2025.
Heavy research, as in very heavy books, like no one can see, but he's got
Yeah.
the increasing mountain of books in the background.
Yeah, trust me, one of the biggest stacks back there is just for like all the Rosicrucian material I've got to sort through. It's
Oh,
going to be insane.
well, what about the Epstein books? Are you still working on those?
Yeah, I'm still working. That's kind of the other thing, though, that's nice about the Kubrick book because it's actually going to enable me to kind of get out some of the stuff that I've been saving for the Epstein books. So I suppose, in a sense, the Kubrick one is maybe partly a continuation of that because we will be looking at some of those blackmail rings in the Kubrick book, that's for sure.
Okay. Excellent. Are you
Yeah.
getting into the movie producer on Long Island? Are you getting into that on in the Kubrick books?
Oh, Roy Raine, you mean?
Roy
Yeah.
Raine? Yeah,
Oh,
you talk
yeah.
about any of that?
Yeah. No, I
Yeah.
definitely will be getting into Roy Raine. I mean, you got to. I'm getting.
That's where I think if there's any truth to the Eyes Wide Shut stuff that he saw or witnessed some things, I think it was the Roy Raine stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Kubrick even lived in Long Island for a time in the late 60s before he relocated to the UK permanently. But there's a lot of crazy stuff about all of that that I'm going to be getting into in the Kubrick book. Yeah, I've actually come to identify quite a bit with Stanley Kubrick because much like him, I always look at these projects like they're going to be this kind of quick one-off. I think when he was getting ready to make Eyes Wide Shut, he thought that the filming would be finished like in 6 months. I think about a year and a half later, he was forced to revise those plans. But yeah, I'm kind of in the same thing. I start these projects and then they just sort of go on for years and years.
Before you tell people where they can find the book, Stephen, the cover of the book.
Yeah, we touched on
What's
that a
the
little
mo
bit.
what's the yeah, what's the motif here?
It was actually inspired by Battle for the Planet of the Apes,
Awesome. Beneath the Planet of the
yeah,
Apes.
Beneath this Planet of the Apes, the second one, because I love the sort of nuclear cult that they have in that, and I thought it was very appropriate to the book because really at the heart of it is U.S. nuclear policy. And I got to give a shout out to my artist Elma Marie. She did a fantastic job in this. She is absolutely freaking amazing. Really excited to start working with her again on the cover for the Kubrick book. But yeah, she really outdid herself with this. It's an amazing
So
cover.
who are all these characters on here? That's Lansdale at the top, top left.
Yeah, with the harmonica. Yeah.
One of
And
them would
then
one
a
of them is a
reference
member.
to Project Penguin with the penguin head.
No, that's the aviary, actually. That was
Oh,
the member of the
okay.
aviary that had the code name Penguin. And then also you've got Adrina Puharic on there, Daniel Ellsberg, and Licklider, I believe. JCR Licklider, who was one of the major people in setting up the ARPANET. And then, of course, below that you've got the gray alien and the UFO
Yeah.
person and the survivalist all sort of crawling up the steps to the nuclear bomb.
The golden ICBM with the Alpha and Omega on it. It's pretty great.
Yeah, right. Dr. Future worked for one of the guys in the aviary, right?
Yeah, no, he's
Told
told me
you
about that
that?
before.
Crazy.
Wright Patterson.
Yeah, no, that's priceless. I
What's
mean, what
next? Oh, go
he
ahead.
addressed the UN too at one point, right? Like one of those like woo-woo new age groups within
Yeah,
it.
it was something that was going on in Montreal.
Oh my goodness. And he's gotten on the stage of Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is why I will forever love Mike because he is the man for doing that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he Dr.
He's
Future.
something else.
What's been going on with the farm?
Oh, well, we just keep plugging along. I've started to do the Albacore series again. I've been talking a bit about Catalina Island, but we've got the Zoom party actually tomorrow. At least, well, it'll be passed by the time this is out. But yeah, I've been starting to really delve into that again. I've been doing a lot more movie stuff lately. Just, I don't know, it's been kind of fun. We did a show like on Giallo that was really fun. Just recently did a show on Leave the World Behind. A couple of other ones. I'm really hoping to finally do my Elusive Hawkwind show.
Hell
Next to
yeah.
Blue Oyster Cult, Hawkwind is another band I'm freaking obsessed with. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. Should I've had Miguel Connors on to talk about Elvis a bit too. That's been because I was really into sort of that kind of Southern Americana, that kind of mystical Elvis, Highway 61, Robert Johnson, Stagger Lee
Right.
thing, all around
Yeah.
that era. So it's been really kind of fun to revisit some of that stuff now that I'm a little older.
Cool. Awesome. Well, look forward to that stuff. Definitely had to check it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Stephen, I want to thank you for coming on. Where can people find you and where can people find the book?
Well, you can hear the shows. I have one free show up weekly on Mondays and also two shows for subscribers. And then at the upper tier, you get the additional shows and a bunch of other goodies, including the Zoom party presentations and everything else. And this is all for the Farm Podcast. You can find that through pretty much a Google search doing the Farm Podcast Mach 2. So yeah, definitely keep that in mind. And then the book is The Art, The Secret History of Cywar Conspiratainment and the Shattering Reality of Book One, which you can find at the Farm's official store, which is the Farm Podcast, all one word, dot store. And also the physical copies are available at Amazon. So there you go.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you for being on the show, as always.
Thank
And
you guys so much for having me on.
absolutely. And guys, you know where you can find us. You can find us anywhere podcasts are. And we are also on YouTube as well, on Conspiranormal Podcast channel. And Sir Fiel can tell you where to find our Patreon.
You can find that at patreon.com/conspiranormal. We're going to be delivering some more weekly episodes. Got some in the works. So be on the lookout for that.
We sure do. All right, guys, thank you so much. And we will be back next time with Robert Guffey on Conspiranormal.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.